it's just not possible to gain that much in value that quickly with declining revenue.
And that's when I really had the epiphany that investing was not about stocks and bonds. Investing is about innovation.
The belief is if there's a new piece of information, that it will be instantly incorporated into the price of the stock or the bond or whatever. But that's not how people change their minds.
Welcome back. I'm Hayden Brain, and you're listening to Opto Sessions, where we interview the top traders and investors from around the world, uncovering their secrets to success. On Wednesday, 15th of December, we hosted our latest live interview on Twitter Spaces with hedge fund and SPAC expert Julian Klimochko. Julian is CEO at Accelerate Financial Technologies, a company democratizing alternative investment by offering institutional caliber hedge fund and private equity strategies in the form of low-cost ETFs. One of Accelerate's strategies, ARB, ARB, provides exposure to SPAC arbitrage. So, Julian identifies the advantages of an arbitrage approach before highlighting the common pitfalls. We also discuss the unprecedented momentum seen in SPAC uptake over the past year before Julian concludes by offering his 2022 outlook. Enjoy.
Welcome, Julian. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. Excited to get into it today.
Yeah, great. So today I want to dig into SPACs, a fairly obvious topic given that we've got you on the line. I want to, I suppose, first set out by describing why they've received so much attention this year, then compare them to other listing vehicles, and then maybe finish by addressing the methods in which people can gain investment exposure to them. But firstly, I read earlier this month that 942 companies have gone public in 2021, with 599 of those listed as SPACs versus 383 IPOs and 7 direct listings. So do you think a SPAC is the superior listing vehicle? And if so, why?
Yeah, so you went through a lot there. Now, with respect to being a superior listing vehicle, as with anything, it depends. In certain cases, it's advantageous, which is why many of a certain type of company are utilizing it. But in other situations, it's not necessary. So you compare SPACs versus the other methods of taking a private company public. First one, and this is a really niche one, that would be direct listings. I believe about only 7 companies have used a direct listing. I think direct listings are probably the cheapest and perhaps most accurate way to price a stock in terms of going public. But two key features with a direct listing is it doesn't come with capital. So it's only appropriate for companies not seeking to raise capital. And number two, it really comes with no like marketing roadshow or anything like that. So it's typically utilized by well-known consumer brands that have well-capitalized balance sheets, such as Spotify, for example. And then next is the traditional IPO, which most people would be aware of, the initial public offering. Now, historically, you know, that's how Apple went public, that's how Amazon went public, and that's how Microsoft went public. However, over the past 20 years, we have seen private companies, take Uber, for example, stay private longer and longer, such that by the time they finally go public, there's basically no growth left. And the traditional IPO has morphed into an exit opportunity for earlier stage backers, such as venture capitalists and private equity firms. So the traditional IPO is no longer used to fund growth, true growth companies. It's more so utilized as an exit opportunity for private equity and venture capitalists. So then in comes the SPAC, a special purpose acquisition company, which fits the niche of allowing earlier stage companies, like true growth companies, to raise a large amount of capital and do it relatively quickly. So versus the direct listing, SPACs come with a significant amount of capital. So that is one thing. Granted, it's far more expensive and dilutive than a direct listing. And then versus traditional IPO, SPACs have a number of key features worth consideration. So number one is speed. SPAC going public transaction can be as little as 3 to 5 months. Meanwhile, a traditional IPO can take 18 months. And as we all know, timing is everything. And within an 18-month time frame, you could actually have not just one cycle, but probably a couple. And so timing is super, super important when considering taking a private company public. A couple other features. A private company going public via a SPAC can generally raise a significantly more amount of capital versus their equity market capitalization as you could in a traditional IPO. For example, it's not unheard of for a private company to raise half of their equity market cap in terms of new equity financing and a SPAC going public transaction or business combination. Meanwhile, traditional IPO, they generally raise around 10% of their equity market cap or so. So a SPAC transaction comes with a significantly more equity capital attached to it. And then one of the most important parts is that when you have like an early stage growth company, say that it is not only pre-profit, but also pre-revenue, utilizing historical financial statements, which is all you can use in the traditional S1 of an IPO, you can only disclose historical financial statements. So if you invest in earlier stage companies, you know that historical financial statements are effectively useless. And what you're concerned about is what the company is going to look in, say, 3 to 5 years. So you are relying on forecasts and estimates. So companies going public via SPAC, since it's technically a merger, they can utilize and communicate forecasts and estimates to investors to get them excited about the story and market the stock. Meanwhile, they cannot use that by a traditional IPO. And I think that's one of the main reasons why earlier stage companies, traditionally ones that would stay private longer, they're choosing to go public via SPACs because they can communicate that message. They can disclose their forecasts and estimates to investors in order to tell their story. Now, ultimately, it's up to the investor to believe it or not with respect to the forecasts. But that's generally how you invest in these earlier stage opportunities. So those are basically the key differences between SPACs and IPOs. I mean, one minor one, in addition, is the sponsor is highly incentivized to get a deal done that will hopefully make stock go up because they have skin in the game. So that incentive is also why you've seen just this massive proliferation of SPACs. And as you noted, the majority of companies going public are doing so via blank check companies.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You set the scene then. And there's a few things I want to dig into. But before we do, we mentioned direct listings at the top of the call. They'd previously, I guess, in some quarters, been considered a threat to other listing models. But why do you think they failed to capitalize on some of that early momentum, given, as you say, I think there were only 7 this year?
Yeah, so they really disappointed in terms of the hype. They were heavily hyped. But at the end of the day, like I said, they're only appropriate for a very small segment of private companies. That is very well established private companies that have perhaps fortified balance sheet or excess capital, which in startup land is quite rare. And also companies with great consumer brand in the market, which is rare. It's like not many private companies have the brand value of a Spotify or a Slack, right? And so you're really not seeing it utilized by companies that aren't massive private consumer brands with large followings. I think it's that simple.
Yeah, okay, sure. And this year, we talked about the momentum and the growth we've seen in SPAC listings over the course of 2021, but do we expect that to continue into 2022? And if so, what about the market environment is conducive to further SPAC uptake?
Yeah, certainly low interest rates is playing a part, and the demand by investors for earlier stage growth opportunities, which is probably the main driver in the popularity of SPACs. So the reason that they got so popular 18 months ago is two factors, one on the supply side, one on the demand side. So on the supply side, it can be very lucrative for a SPAC sponsor if they do conduct a successful business combination. If they don't, then it's financially painful. So it certainly is risky. But for those talented individuals or sponsors that can do it, can be highly lucrative if done well. Then on the demand side, for the past 20 years, has been this misconception in the market that public company investors, public market investors, only want to invest in stable, steadily growing, profitable enterprises that show consistent numbers quarter in, quarter out. But what I believe was that was disproven by probably the Virgin Galactic deal in which it was a company going public that was not only pre-profit, but pre-revenue and wasn't expected to generate revenue for many, many years. And that was just a huge hit in the market. And it unveiled this massive desire from public market investors to get those earlier stage investment opportunities kind of in more so at the ground floor before they mature. And so those are the dynamics that drove this massive flood of supply. And that has only continued. I mean, we've had even month to date, the amount of IPO issuance, we've seen 39 SPAC IPOs raising $8 billion. So it's a combination of that sponsor incentive and then the demand from investors on the types of opportunities that they get shown in the SPAC business combination model. In addition to that, and I can get into this, one major kind of cog in the wheel feeding the whole SPAC boom are hedge funds, such as mine, who subscribe to these IPOs because I believe, and others believe this too, that participating in a SPAC IPO as a SPAC arbitrager is perhaps the best risk-reward dynamic in the market today.
Yeah, great. That would work as the perfect segue to get into SPAC arbitrage, which I do want to get into later. But there's a couple of points that you mentioned prior to that one that I wanted to dig into. You mentioned the Virgin Galactic IPO. So that was a bit of, I mean, arguably an inflection point for SPAC kind of listings, as it were, companies that you said weren't generating revenue, weren't generating profits, but did manage to generate the interest and the momentum around its listing that perhaps historically hadn't been the case. Well, does that mean that we'll see more similarly sized and similarly defined SPAC listings like Virgin Galactic kind of into 2022? And if so, what sorts of companies could that be? Are there any on the horizon that we should look out for?
Yeah, the thing about SPACs is that it's highly cyclical and it's subject to what I call flavor of the month dynamics, in that if you look how things have developed, just even the last 12 months, we went through a period where electric vehicles were super hot with the Lucid deal, now Polestar, then battery tech was really hot and hyped up, and then EV charging. So it goes through all these kind of micro themes. So I don't really know exactly what the next sort of theme will be, but just a few months ago, I remember Legato, which is a SPAC, announced a business combination with a steel producer, Algoma Steel, and that one actually traded really well. So, and now the flavor of the month is Trump Media and Digital World Acquisition, right? Which is just crazy in and of itself. So you never really know what the flavor of the month is going to be, which is why my approach to the SPAC market is to be highly diversified, because you never really know what the market's sort of going to become infatuated with and what the next big thing is. Who knows? I think you have seen a number of SPACs targeting cryptocurrency. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more deals focused on NFTs, non-fungible tokens, and really just anything that's latest and greatest in the hype cycle. We do see some SPACs kind of getting involved there.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I haven't necessarily thought about it like that. So to apply a kind of sector or even thematic lens when looking at the SPAC market arguably wouldn't be the best way to approach it, given that it is so sporadic and therefore diversification is key.
Yeah, like the thing about the way I like to view what a single SPAC is, it's basically like a T-bill with an equity call option. So there's a saying that you would prefer a basket of options as opposed to an option on a basket. So when you own a diversified portfolio of SPACs, you can think of it as a diversified portfolio of T-bills, each with an equity call option on it. So basically, you have all these low-risk positions with a mini lotto ticket on it. And you never know, maybe you own DWAC in there and then it goes up 5X, right? Which is the type of exposure that you want. But point being is, prior to them announcing that, you never know which one is going to sort of catch the eye of the market to produce those explosive upside returns, right? And even the most heavily hyped SPACs can announce a dud of a deal and the most low-profile SPACs can announce huge winners. So you want exposure to those. And the only way to do it, unless, of course, you are a mind reader or good at telling forecasts in the future, is to just have that diversified exposure.
Yeah, sure. Okay, got it. Well, before we move on to arbitrage, then we should discuss the risks, I guess, just to give a relatively balanced conversation. I saw a video, who was it from? I think it was Gary Gensler the other day, discussing the industry's lack of adequate disclosures and kind of calls for more transparency across the board. But what's your take on that? I mean, do you think there's room to enhance the disclosures made by the companies raising money for SPACs, for instance?
Yeah, I think that's a somewhat controversial subject. Like, you open up an S1 or the registration statement on a SPAC merger, and it's literally hundreds and hundreds of pages, so there's a tremendous amount of legalese. I'd be a fan of more simplified disclosure, not necessarily like thousands of pages. I read through these documents, and I've been a financial professional for a long time and have read thousands and thousands of these. Are they easy to discern for the non-professional? No, it's basically impossible. However, you look at what Gary Gensler is saying, and is, I think, well, the average retail investor doesn't even read these, probably doesn't even open them, or frankly, is probably not even aware of what they are. So what is he complaining about? You know, I'm a bit confused on that. However, you know, it's a type of asset that I think should be the realm of professional investors, because it's very, can be very difficult to analyze. And takes basically like a full-time team to be able to operate properly in this space, just given the administrative and operational risks behind it. And you talked about risks, and I do want to address, because if you affect a SPAC arbitrage strategy properly, it's perhaps one of the lowest risk strategies out there. But I call it an investment strategy that's simple but not easy. And therein lies the risks, is that it's somewhat easy to screw up. So number one is price. And I saw this dynamic play out time and time again in the first quarter. Investors were just paying too much for pre-deal SPACs. And they would say, oh, this is a Chamath social capital SPAC. I don't mind paying $15, a 50% premium to NAV. I'm like, well, that's $10 in cash. You have a tremendous amount of downside here. What are you doing? You're buying at really stupid prices. So the first risk is paying too high of a price. I have a rule. I never pay above net asset value or the trust value, the cash value per share, which these days is generally $10.20 per SPAC common share. We always buy at or below that because that limits your downside risk. Number two is the redemption. So that's really our out. And this is kind of the absolute crux. The key tenet of SPAC arbitrage is relying on that redemption mechanism, which works in this way. So SPAC announces a business combination, files the registration statement or the proxy, and then sets the deal vote. So the way that a SPAC works and what makes it so popular with hedge funds is two business days prior to the vote, they offer you the opportunity to redeem your SPAC common shares at that net asset value, call it $10.20. And so it basically removes price risk. You can imagine a SPAC has an embedded put option. And when that option, that put option goes away, then I no longer consider it a SPAC. It is just it converts basically into a regular way equity. And this is where like the big risks come in, because if you miss that redemption date, there's no more floor. There's nothing stopping it from dropping to $8, $5, $2. And people say, oh, these SPACs have done so poorly. They're all trading at $5. Well, guess what? Those aren't SPACs. Those deals closed. They ceased being SPACs long ago, and now they're equities. But the point being is that de-SPACs, or companies that went public by SPAC, historically have underperformed. So I would like to caution investors on that. Like my rule, like I have two rules in running. I run an ETF, the Accelerate Arbitrage Fund ETF, and we affect this diversified SPAC arbitrage strategy. We have two rules. The first one is never buy above net asset value. So we're always buying at or below net asset value. So as long as we can hold until maturity, we know 100% of the time we're going to make money. Number two is we never hold past closing. Ideally, we sell after deal announcement at a premium to NAV. If not, then we redeem prior to the vote such that we eliminate price risk. So those are our two rules and how an investor can run this strategy, a SPAC arbitrage investment strategy, in a very low risk, absolute manner, such that you can be confident you'll make money every time.
Yeah, sure. So just to kind of give a bit more color to that, I guess then, is it true that SPACs generally to trade at discount to NAV? You know, is that kind of, can you talk to us about the kind of the mechanics of that?
Yeah, so currently the average SPAC common share is trading at, I'll just get a current price here. Average is at 998. It's probably much lower on a median basis, but the fact of the matter is currently 95% of SPAC common shares are at a discount to NAV. And so as long as you're buying before the deal is announced and, you know, buy something with 9 in front of it instead of 10 that hasn't announced a deal, and you should be fine. But you got to track it closely because, like I said, you don't want to miss that redemption date when it comes up, should you need it.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So essentially, there's a return available to investors outside of, or I guess before the optionality side of the equation is even considered. And by that, I mean the potential upside due to the announcement of a favorable merger target. Is that fair?
Yeah. And so one thing to consider is that, in my opinion, it's the best risk-reward dynamic of any security out there. That being said, it's not a strategy that'll shoot the lights out. You're not going to double your money doing this. I mean, we're looking to hit singles. That means high single-digit annualized return. If we can generate 7 to 8% annualized in a low-risk manner with this strategy, we're very happy. We consider this an alternative fixed income strategy. And I realize that many individual investors, they have higher expected returns. They're like, well, I want to double my money. This is a strategy that most certainly is not going to do that. So it's a very conservative strategy and more so analogous to a bond or a fixed income strategy and not something that is going to shoot the lights out. And many complain that it's dead money, but when executed properly, you can generate, I believe, 7 to 8% annualized returns in a low-risk manner. But for the most part, it's like watching paint dry because there's not much volatility at all.
Yeah, sure. And historically, then, has the ETF hit that 7 to 8% annual return?
Yep. So last year, we were up 30%, which was obviously way above expectations, but an outlier. We don't expect that to repeat. And this year, we're up almost 8% year-to-date.
Yeah, great. And you likened it there to fixed income within your kind of personal portfolio, if that exists. Like, is that how you treat it? You've kind of got a segment of your portfolio with these less exciting assets, this less exciting strategy, to kind of use your phrase, but then do you have room to be a bit more exciting with the rest of the portfolio, more tactical side of the portfolio perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. So I like to run a diversified asset allocation, and by diversified I mean strategies with low correlations to each other that will act differently compared to each other. For example, our SPAC arbitrage strategy is completely uncorrelated from stocks and bonds. So in markets where the stock market has traded down significantly, take it for like September or something when the S&P was down 5%, this SPAC arbitrage strategy just keeps chugging along with good returns. And so it moves independently of traditional asset classes, which is important when structuring a portfolio. And I classify SPAC arbitrage as low risk. So it's in the low risk bucket of my portfolio. And then between that, like on the other end of my portfolio, I own Bitcoin, I own Ethereum, and I own a basket of NFTs. Those are extremely speculative and incredibly high risk. And in between those two low risk and very high risk strategies, I have a bunch of other strategies. I have equity strategies, long short strategies, and stocks, other things like that, private companies, public companies. So yeah, it's important to consider those dynamics when conducting asset allocation. I talked to some individual investors, they're like, oh, I'm 100% in SPACs, or I'm 100% in options and warrants, or I'm 100% in NFTs and crypto. I'm just like, you know, that is insane. I think you should limit each asset class to, you know, depending on the risk, but a high risk asset class, you should keep within a single digit percent of your portfolio, say crypto or NFTs. Lower risk, such as SPACs, I'd say, you know, low double digits, maybe 10 to 20%. And then, you know, just be diversified with as many asset classes as you can. Equities, real estate, crypto, SPACs, bonds, cash. You know, there's a ton of options for investors these days, so why not use them? They say diversification is the only free lunch in investing, so investors should be eating that, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And on the equity side of your portfolio, I hadn't planned to ask it, but whilst we're here, I'm just kind of interested to get your take on time horizons, I suppose, because this SPAC arbitrage strategy plays out. I guess you're kind of reviewing it almost constantly, but you look for that 7 to 8% annual return. For your equities, is it kind of a longer term time horizon? Are you investing in kind of hyper growth companies? How does that side of the portfolio look?
Yeah, exactly. And so you nailed it with respect to SPACs. And the reason why I like it as a fixed income alternative strategy is it can do well in a rising rate environment because the duration is very low. It's a high turnover strategy. The duration in our RBTF is about 10 months. And so it can readjust to those higher yields as interest rates tick up. But on the equity side, I'm a buy and hold guy. I'm not a trader. So when I buy stock or basically I'm buying a portion of the business, I look to hold for the long term, i.e. 5+ years or hopefully a long holding period. I am on the board of directors of a public company and I'm a shareholder in that company called Bitcoin Well. And I've been a shareholder for a number of years and will continue to be so. And you know, I do have a bunch of stocks that I've held very long term. Berkshire Hathaway, Constellation Software, companies such as that have long-term confidence in management that you just sit back and enjoy the returns. And I mean, it takes a lot of work to be an active trader, and I just don't have time for that. So I have select equity investments that I've held for a very long time, and I'll continue to do so. And you know, it's good to have within your asset allocation framework, not just diversification of asset classes, but diversification of durations as well. Because you never know when you'll need liquidity, and you can think of stocks as long duration assets, but they're prone to 50% plus drawdowns. And with a short duration, low risk strategy, such as SPAC arbitrage, you're just not going to get that drawdown. So in times when you need liquidity, when you need capital, it could be a good way to access that while getting a premium to, say, cash.
Yeah, of course. And that diversification of duration, I think, is a really important point and not one that I often hear. I, as ever, tend to get carried away with these conversations and forget to bring other people in. So, of course, if anyone does want to request to be a speaker, just go ahead and do so. I've got a couple more questions of my own, and otherwise we'll end after that. But obviously, just request and I'll bring you in if you do have a question. We're kind of approaching the start of 2022, and rightly or wrongly, people tend to kind of reassess their financial lives at the start of a new year. So if someone were to consider, and I guess by someone we're talking about an individual retail investor, if they were to consider adopting a SPAC arbitrage strategy heading into 2022, what sort of top tips would you give them? What bit of guidance would you ensure they followed?
Well, it's a strategy that's simple, not easy. So as long as you're willing to dedicate, 60 hours per week to it, and you have the time to kind of dedicate basically your whole life to it, that's what it takes to affect it in a proper manner. And if you don't have that dedication to the craft, then I just don't think it's worthwhile because you're probably not going to do well. So yeah, number one, it's just the amount of time and effort required for this type of strategy is significant, just so you don't make any major mistakes. And yeah, it's a major one. And number two, if you want to produce good, consistent returns, it's a great strategy. But if you're looking for high risk, high volatility, kind of shoot the lights out type returns, you're not going to find it in SPAC arbitrage. It's a relatively conservative strategy. I know that a different part of the SPAC market, many investors like the action within SPAC warrants, because that's a type of strategy that is high risk, high volatility, and you can kind of multiply your money. But keep in mind that those are highly levered bets on equities, basically, and they can go to zero. So, you know, a SPAC warrant kind of long-only strategy that's directional in nature, that's one that I think resonates with a lot of retail investors who are looking for those high-risk bets. But it's not a strategy that I follow.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, we've alluded to it already. I mean, it's a busy market, one with a fair amount of noise. So to kind of cut through that, are there any sort of publishers, I don't know, people on social media, information sources of any description really that you would suggest following to kind of make sure you're properly across the SPAC market?
Yeah, so there's a number of really good SPAC analysts on Twitter. I think Twitter is probably your best resource. So if you just kind of try to follow the top SPAC accounts, I think that would help you out tremendously, because there isn't, like a Goldman Sachs SPAC research or anything like that. So, it's a brand new asset class and it's still developing. But with respect to new asset classes, whether they be crypto or NFTs or SPACs, you'll find all the best analysis through Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, great. That's all the questions from me, Julian. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a great conversation. So great questions.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Just a quick note before we sign off. If you're looking for an easily digestible daily update on the markets, this might be of interest. Opto Updates is our short newsletter sent every day during the trading week, giving you a bulleted list of the top 7 stories from the global stock markets. We've done the hard work for you, highlighting relevant opportunities and trends. And in addition, we'll also keep you notified of any new products, stock reports, or webinars from the Opto world. If you're interested, sign up using the link in the show notes. And thanks also to CoFruition for consulting on and producing the show. Until next time. CoFruition.